Okay, good evening. We will call to order the Boulder Town Planning Commission meeting of April 11th, 2019. First, we will establish a quorum. We have three of our commission members present. We have myself, Josie Muse, who is the acting chair. We have Matt Cochran and Elizabeth Julian. In addition, we have two staff members, Peg Smith, secretary, and our zoning administrator, Curtis Overhensley. And our town council liaison tonight is Steve Cox, I assume. No? Oh, he's back there. Wonderful. He's there. Okay, our town council representative is Peter Benson. Okay, so the first item is just do a brief overview of the agenda of the business we have tonight. We've established a quorum, so we'll go ahead and move forward with the business. We are going to start with old business, and then shortly thereafter, we will have a 10-minute period for public comments. We'll limit each commenter to, it wasn't in the minutes, we discussed a time limit. Was it 1 minute per commenter, approximately?
Like 10 minutes total?
10 minutes total? Okay, that works. After that, we're going to have a presentation on Dark Skies Initiative from Mary Bedingfield Smith. Correct? Okay. After that presentation, we're going to have a public hearing, which will start at 7 p.m., and that will be on the residential short-term rental ordinance. And then we will move into the business of discussing those comments and vote to move that ordinance forward. We'll also be discussing subdivision ordinance revisions in relation to water and development. We'll move into general plan updates and schedule that public hearing for next month. And then we'll have another period open for public comments at the end of the meeting. Okay, so with that, first item on the agenda is old business, and that is approving our March minutes.
Did you get the comments that Perry emailed in about the ones for the...
I saw that he had comments. I didn't have time to read them, but I'll get those included.
Okay. I have first comments from the March 14th.
First, we have to make a motion to approve the minutes.
Do you have anything to add?
I have no comments. I'm good with it.
And I have no comments either, so if you want them, do you want to make a motion?
So, motion to approve the March minutes.
And second it? Okay, that's seconded by Elizabeth Julian. Great. Okay, and so at this point, we're going to go ahead and close the commission meeting and open a public comment period. We have 10 minutes to do that business. Do we have any tapers? Okay. All right, if we have no one with a public comment, we're going to go ahead and move forward to the next item on the agenda. So we'll close the public comment period and reopen the commission meeting, and we're going to go into an informational presentation on dark skies. Our presenter is Mary Bedingfield Smith.
Thank you very much for allowing me to come over and talk to you about dark skies. I'm not well tech savvy, so I'm just going to leave it at that second. So the reason why I put this in here was because I became interested in dark skies because where we live in Torrey, I'm just outside of town. This is my house right here, so I may be a quarter of a mile away, and this is a building in town. So I'm one block off of Main Street in Torrey. And about the first night my husband and I lived here, there was this light that was shining from the town hall on a street pole, and it illuminated the entire row of coffee trees for the rest of our house. And we moved here from Logan because the same reason that lots of people do, it's so gorgeous, and we wanted to see the stars, and I thought, what the heck is that light on the trees? And it actually cast shadows, our shadows on our house. So anyway, that began my interest in learning about dark skies. So, I was asked to talk about kind of the process of establishing a dark sky community, all the steps that you have to go through. And one of the things that's really important for you to do is to make sure that you have a lot of local support. And that's not just local support from the people who move in. It's local support from people who have lived here for their whole life. And also from business people. Because all of this affects those residents and those businesses in positive and maybe negative ways. So however it is you decide you're going to get local support, whether it's just one-on-one conversations or however that might be, you need to be sure that you have it. Otherwise, you're going to have a lot of pushback. So once you decide that you have local support, then the next thing you need to do is you need to contact the International Dark Sky Association. The man you talk to is John Barentine, and John will hold your hand all the way through the process. He's very, very gracious to work with you. And once you contact him from the very beginning, you don't really do anything right from the start. It's just that you have to establish that initial contact. And then when you're really ready to get moving on it, then you'll talk to John and he'll ask you a few questions. And the first question he'll ask you is, are you incorporated? Because you have to be incorporated in order to be considered, because you have to have ordinances. And the first ordinance that you're going to have is you're going to have a dark sky ordinance. So once you are thinking about having your dark sky ordinance, you really, really, really have to educate your citizens. And you need to get their input about, you know, what their perceptions are about what a dark sky ordinance means. Because a lot of times when people say the word dark sky, or they hear that, they think that that means we can't have any lights. And that's not at all what dark sky means. Dark sky just means that you have the right amount of light at the right time, pointed in the right direction, fully shielded. So that means that the light goes down instead of coming out horizontally, and especially not going straight up in the sky. And you also want to be sure that you're minimizing blue light emissions. So when I first started talking about dark skies and Tories, people said, well, Mary, I'm reading this or I'm reading that about the dangers of blue light, that high-intensity blue light that you see in headlights. A lot of LED lights have that really blue look to it. And so one of the things to consider is, what is the temperature of the lights that you're asking people to install in their houses or what you're going to put on their poles? And the International Dark Sky Association has limits as to what that temperature could be. So the lower the temperature, the warmer or the yellower the light looks. So the limit, that the highest temperature you can have on a street light is, the light temperatures are measured in Kelvin rather than centigrade. So 3,000 Kelvin is the highest you can see. And even when you're trying to replace your street lights, now they actually make 2,700 Kelvin lights. But when we were replacing our street lights, the lowest that they made was 3,000 Kelvin. So when it comes to the temperature, when you buy a fixture, even if you just buy it at Home Depot, it will say right on the box what the temperature of the light is. And another thing to consider is the lumens. That's the amount of light that actually comes out of the bulb. And the lumen is also written on the fixture box, or if you're just buying bulbs, the lumen is written on the bulbs as well. So it's easy to see what it is you're trying to get. So if you say to people, well, we want to have you install dark sky lights, a lot of times you can go to the store and you can see dark sky approved symbols on the boxes, but you don't have to have a light like that. You just have to look at the temperature and look at the lumens, and then you know that the light bulb itself is going to comply with whatever the ordinance is happening to be.
What's the limit on lumens, Dan? Do you know?
There's not a limit on lumens individually, but where the limit comes in is on an entire piece of property. There's a overall limit as to the amount of light that can come from an overall property. And now, the International Dark Sky Association, which I'm just going to call IDA for the rest of the night, they'll say, if you have a 10-acre piece of property, you have to still have the limit on the entire piece of property. So let's say that the limit is 25,000 lumens. So they can't put 50,000 lumens on 1 acre of their property and average it across the 10 acres. It is, the total property has this amount of lumens. And one of the reasons why you want to do that is because sometimes businesses are thinking, well, the wider I make my signage, the more people are going to come to my business. So you end up with this competition between businesses of putting more lights and putting more lights, and pretty soon they're going to be over the amount. But they'll say, well, my lot's 3 acres, and so if you average it over my 3 acres, I'm still going to work. But you can't do that.
So is it per acre? Excuse me.
I don't know exactly what it is right now, because things change from year to year to year. So it was interesting when I started doing this. I was looking at my own lights, my exterior lights on my house. And first of all, they weren't shielded. So I had to create a shield over it. And then I started looking at the lumens. And each one of those little candle light bulbs is about 3,000 lumens. I was shocked. I had no idea that's how much lumens it was, like a little tiny. So you'll just have to work with John and he'll tell you what the rules are now. I know that one of the things that people worry about is safety. If you make me put all my lights down, then I'm not going to be able to see if there are any bad guys out there or mischief makers. So you know when you're driving west in the evening and the sun's going down and it's right into your windshield, and so you put your hand right there so you can see where you're going. Well, these next couple of pictures I'm going to show you kind of illustrate what you can see what you can see with an unshielded light and what you can see with a shielded light. So this is a backyard, obviously, and that light is an unshielded light. And what happens with that glare of the unshielded light is it creates dark shadows that you can't really see into. So this image is somebody just the same place. They held their hand up in front of the light bulb, and now you can see what's in the shadows. It just really is a...
Is that an actor or is that a real bad guy?
The hand is real, the guy would be. And these images come from IDEA, and they're very helpful in helping you find all sorts of images and materials to share. These brochures that I brought, they just give them to you for free. So this is a good image to show people when they're worried about safety. So let's say, okay, you're to the point where you're wanting to install or consider what kind of street light you want to put in. So it's nice for them to have an example to show people what street lights would look like. And what we did was I contacted Garcane Energy. I'm imagining that Garcane is your supplier as well.
Yes.
They're great to work with. Really, really, really good to work with. So the person that I call when I need a light installed is Philip Bird. But when we started talking about all this, I was always talking to Dan Plendon, who's the CEO of Garcane Energy, and they've all been extremely supportive. So I said, Philip, I need an example light. Do you know where you can get one? And they were looking at the time for shielded light. Because Garcane now, my understanding is, if you want to put a new street light, they're not going to put those orange high-pressure lights. They don't even install those anymore. Everything that they install now is those overhead lights, LEDs with all the light directed down. But I said, okay, get us a sample light. And so they did. And so they put it up so people could see it. And this is the sample light. And all of these are the other lights that we want to replace. This is a mercury vapor light, and these are the high-pressure sodium lights. And this is the new light. So people looked at it, and they said, yeah, that's what we want. So one of the things to think about with those high-pressure sodium lights is you can see here, you'll hear the term light trespass. So this is a good example of what light trespass is. Instead of the light being directed on what you want to illuminate, it illuminates everything that's all around, the neighbor's house, the sky. A lot of the energy that you're paying for with that light bulb is just going up to the sky. It's not helping you on the ground. So then, this is a picture. It's a long picture, but that's one street light that was replaced, and you can see all the light is on the ground. So when you start looking at these lights, cobra head lights, they come in various types. And the type of the light tells you what kind of illumination pattern is going to be on the ground. So because we were replacing street lights, we wanted type 2 lights, which is that long, narrow light that's going to go right along the street. So this is a type 2, 3,000 Kelvin light pointing at the ground. Actually, when you drive up to it, it's not even that bright because we had to have the camera open for a while in order to get that picture. But there's plenty of light right on the road. And that's at a corner, too, so people can see where it is in nature. So then you have to get a plan to replace your streetlights, because IDA, that's one of the things IDA wants to do, is they want you to replace your streetlights if they're filled with high-pressure sodium light. So you have to figure out, you have to inventory your lights. So in Torrey Town didn't really know which of the street lights or security lights were Torrey Town lights. And Garcan didn't really know either. So Garcan came to town and they got out all their records and they figured out that Torrey had responsibility for 22 lights. And then there were a number of other lights that looked like street lights, but they were really privately owned and paid for security lights. So the lights that Torrey wanted to pay attention to were just the street lights that they were responsible for. So the way that towns typically pay for that power is you pay a monthly, what they call a tariff, to Garcan Energy, which per month is something like $9.50 for each one of those lights. If you replace your lights at your own expense, to these kind of lights, then it cuts the tariff to about $4.50. So you have your budget expenditure for that kind of electricity. And even for private property owners who have a security light, if they replace that light on their own, at their own expense, then they cut their tariff as well. The only time that wouldn't go down is if they chose it to do the paying sort of method, which, where they pay for the actual electricity. And so individuals have their own arrangement with Garcan. And if they decide that they want to, replace the light, then they can ask Garcan to just switch them over to the tariff, monthly tariff, and they're able to do that. And so one of the things that we've done is we replace all of our street lights, and then I made an inventory of the private security lights, and one by one I'm going to those private people and businesses and asking if we're actually replacing the lights for them so that they don't have to have that expense and it cuts their tariff. So people have been quite receptive to that. And then I have had to follow up with the owners to make sure that they get that reduction in tariff, but when they just look at their bill and they can see it right away. So the Garcan essentially just does it automatically. So the next thing you have to figure out after you're working with Garcan and getting your inventory is where you're going to get your money from. So I don't know what the socioeconomic level is in Boulder, but the socioeconomic level in Torrey is very low. And more than 51% of our population is at the poverty level. So we didn't want to have an expense for the town, or we didn't want to have an expense for individuals. So Torrey raised money with crowdfunding. So we went to an organization, an online crowdfunding organization that specializes in community projects. And it's called IOB, and it stands for In Our Backyard, as opposed to Not In Our Backyard. And we just did a campaign, and we raised $22,000, and we replaced all the town lights, and it worked very nice. But the $22,000 doesn't all go toward the street lights. There are other things in our program that money is going to go toward. We have this bucket of money now so that we can help private individuals who live in town if they want to switch out their lights. I can pay for that for them. We have an education plan. We have a walkway plan that's going to have signage. There'll be a partnership with the high school and all the preschool kids to help with that. So all of that is in the budget. So that's where we raised all of that money. So how much do you have to pay for one streetlight? Well, if Garcane put the streetlight up, Garcane is the electrical company that's going to put the streetlight for you. So for each streetlight, Garcane charges you $145 per light, just labor to go up and down the pole. And then you have to pay for the light on top of that. And you can decide if you want to go with the Garcane lights or if you want to find your light somewhere else. So we started all of our lights with the Garcane light because that's all we knew about. And those are somewhere between $150 and $200. So you're looking at about $350 to replace one light. But when you think about it, I mean, over time, the town, if the town had to pay for it, they can recoup that money. So.
How long did it take you to raise the money through?
6 months.
6 months.
Yeah. And we worked, IOBE is a 501c3, and so the way they structure it is you create a budget, and they'll help you do it. They assign you a liaison, you talk to them on the phone, you get it all geared up. Once you write everything up, then you just send it to your main liaison, and they post it on the website. So what I thought was going to happen was they were going to send it out to all these people around the world, and are going to be the people that give us the money. Yeah, that's not what happens. You put it on the website, but then you have to create your own email list. So you think about all the organizations that have activities here, whatever sort of email list that you have access to, then you are the ones that send that information to your own contacts and, you know, have them spread the word, and then people will start donating. So anyway, then you have to pay IOBE to manage all this. So you can either have, when they collect the money at the end of your campaign, they cannot give the money to you directly if you are not a 501c3. They have to give it to another 501c3, and then that 501c3 can distribute it for you. So if that's the way you do it, then they charge you 3% of what your budget is. And they add that into your campaign total. So once this goes live, you'll see whatever the total is you're trying to get, but that includes that 3%. If you don't have a 501c3 to work with, they will act as your 501c3 to disperse the money for you, but it may charge you 7%. But certainly you have a 501c3 somewhere here in Boulder.
Yeah. So this is your the town apparently didn't
do
this.
No, Entrada was a 501c3. But then after the fact, I realized that I have a 501c3, and there's a bunch of other 501c3s that we could have gone through, so just go through whichever 501c3, and try to have a dark sky initiative, so it fits perfectly with that. So what ended up happening was, because of that, I was able to use, and try to let me use their email list. So if you have a 501c3 that has an extensive email list, and their mission statement goes along with what your goals are, you should use that 501c3 organization. And if you don't, then I'm sure that I probably would be happy to help you.
So the town's main job was to do the ordinance, and then the nonprofit did the gathering money?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
So let's say that you got all this done, and then you want to start working on your application for your dark sky designation. So, I want to back up to this. So, we got all of our money for our lights. You don't have to replace all of your lights before you can apply. If you don't have any money to replace your lights, you just have to put a plan into your application that says, we're going to do this and this and this to replace our lights. And I think they give you something like 5 years to replace your lights. But how many streetlights does Boulder have?
Streetlights or total lights?
Total lights.
Well, the town has 2 lights. The rest of them are private.
Now, you probably have other municipal lights besides that. The community center probably has a light and the light of the board. So you have to include all those municipal lights in your plan.
Right. Okay.
So how many other lights do you have?
I've counted about 24, 25.
And Barking?
But they're not all lit at night. Some of them are not lit. So there's maybe less than 15 that are actually lit.
Yeah. Well, they go out.
Yeah.
But the nice thing about continuing your relationship with Garcane is when they sell the light and you're paying them the tariff, they maintain the light. And the light just goes to last something like 25 years, and there's a little sensor on the top, you know, that brings them on at the night, and it's usually the sensor that goes out. So Barkeem will just keep maintaining that light for you. So you just have to let them know. One of the things, I'm going to come back to your ordinance, because I was thinking about the socioeconomic level, when our planning commission wrote our outdoor lighting ordinance, some lighting ordinances have a sunset clause which says, you know, after 7 years, I'm giving a town has to have their life, their own personal life change. But we didn't feel that, we didn't feel comfortable in giving that to our residents, so there's no sunset clause. Once the ordinance was established, anybody that had their lights in place before that, those lights can stay exactly the way they are. They don't have to change it. There's some triggers that make them have to change it. And one of them might be if there was a major exterior remodel or they increased the footprint of the house by a certain amount. That's a trigger. Another trigger is if the property changes ownership, title transfer. And the other trigger is if they actually change the fixture itself, not the light bulb, the fixture itself, and they need to put in a shielded, fully shielded fixture. And they're out there, and they're not really expensive. And you can find them for $20. And most of the time, they look like the little bell sort of thing, and you can get them in various colors, and the light bulb tucks up inside. But one of the things that people have to watch out for is when they get those nice little shape, bell-shaped things, they have to make sure that the light bulb is actually all the way up inside it, because sometimes the light bulb will dangle below it, and that can be fouled. So we got our money for our street lights, and this is Courtney Crocker putting one of them in. And one of the things I want you to be aware of is, so I told you that we got those type 2 lights with the pattern that should go along the street. Well, this part of the light is called the mast. And depending on where the mast is on the pole, if they attach the cobra head onto some particular mast, if this is the street, and you want the light to go this way, if the mast is in the wrong direction, then the light's going to go this way. So it'll go right into somebody's house. So you might want to be standing there when Barkeem changes those lights. So you can say, could you, because while they're up in the pole, but while they're up there, they'll just drill a new hole and move the mast to the right direction, all at the same time. And then Courtney will take a level, or whoever does the installation, and you want to make sure that that cobra head is parallel with the ground, so it's not tipped up, because then you've got the light going out that way. And he'll do it for you. But it's important to be standing there because of that mast issue.
Quality control and installation.
Yes. And Courtney is great. He's just really great. So now you want to do your dark sky application. So every year, the requirements for the application change a little bit. So you're going to have to find out what the new requirements are. Okay. Everything that's happened in the past is probably still going to be there, and then they'll add some new limits or some new things you've got to do. So, be sure that you're working with IDA, and you go to their website, which is darksky.org. You'll find a link that takes you to dark places. So you go to dark places, and all the communities in the world that have got this designation, you can see their application. And the applications range anywhere from like 10 pages to 200 and some pages. So, do whatever works for your town, but look at those examples. But I know that some of the things that you have to have education events. So whenever you do any of these things, I mean, even if you're doing it now, write down the date, if there's an article in the paper, have a copy of the article, take photographs, because you can include, it's nice to include all that in your application. So a couple of education events that we have in Torrey is, we have a farmer's market. Do you guys have a farmer's market?
Yeah, we do.
So we just set up an information table at the farmer's market, and we have dark sky information that we got free from IDA, and then when people come by, we just hand that out and talk to them about it. You can count that as an education event. Another thing that we do in Torrey is when people come to the town hall to get a water hookup, or they're going to start a new business, we have an information packet all about town and the area, and included in there is information about lighting. So that's just two examples. education fit. So like I said, you can find more examples on the website. You have to have 10 examples of light installations that have happened once your ordinance is in place. And I kept thinking, we're not gonna have 10. But they'll work with you if you don't have 10. And so a nice thing to do is, if you know that somebody's building a house, just make sure you talk to them and say, can I take a photograph of your house before you put the light on, or if they've already got it on and it goes with your ordinance, then just take a picture of it and put it into your application. Or if there's a business that changes hands, take a picture of their lighting before and then take a picture after so you can put it in your document. You also have to have letters of support, so anybody, any citizen or any business that supports you, just have them write a letter of support. I had, you want to have one from your town council, so if you need to write it up, then you can write it up for the town council and then they can sign it, have the mayor sign it. Dan McClendon from Barcane Energy wrote a letter of support, so you can get your letters anywhere. And if you haven't already replaced your street light, you're going to have a timeline for street lighting or municipal lighting change. And then you also have to have 2 light monitoring events every year. So the way it works in Torrey is because Entrada has this dark sky initiative, they sponsor these monitoring events. And we have a guy in Torrey, Gary Pinkhammer, who used to own Cafe Diablo. He loves this sort of stuff. So Entrada purchased for the monitoring events these little meters that you just take out with your little bird that goes with you, and you hold them up to the sky and you take the reading, and it tells you what it is you need to know, and you write it down and you put it in an Excel spreadsheet. So if you're not already doing that, you might want to find out more information about that, and I can put you in touch with Gary and he can tell you all about that. Because what you want to do is you want to show that you're trending toward darker and darker. So the numbers on your meter, if it's bright, you're going to be like 19, 18, 17. The lower the number, the brighter the sky is. So you want higher numbers. So 21 is a good, 20 in the 20s is good numbers. So when you get up to 22, then you know you're really dark. So if you think about Capitol Reef National Park, which is a gold tier designated National Dark Sky Park, that means their numbers are in the 22s. So Torrey's numbers right now are between 21 and 22. And it was amazing that once we changed our streetlights, you could measure, you had the evidence that it was darker. Yeah. But people still had their lights that they wanted at their house. So you'll say, and get around. I'm going to back up to that just a little bit. You can have a motion sensor light too. And motion sensor lights typically are not shielded. I have not found a good shielded motion sensor light. But people can put those up and they can do whatever their activity is and the light stays on as long as they're out there doing whatever they're doing, or if an intruder comes. But then they just set it for whatever number of minutes you decide you want to have that turned off at. So that's another way to address security issues. And that's been really helpful to many of the elderly people that have lived in Torrey for a long time. Because they go out to get the wood or to see what that noise is and then the light comes on. So that helps a lot. So you have to have your monitoring event. So then what you do, when you're going to have a draft one, a draft two, you see your application, you're going to give it to John, he's going to run it over, and he's going to say, well, you still need this, this picture's on the other page, your page numbers are weird. And then he'll finally say, well, your application is ready, and then he'll submit it for you, and they submit applications quarterly. And he'll let you know all about that. And then your application has to be reviewed and approved by the United States International Dark Sky Group and the International Dark Sky Group. And by the time that John submits your application, you're going to get designated. So then he'll call and let you know that you're designated, and they send you this very nice letter and this beautiful little plaque, and then they help you roll out your announcement. So they'll have to do press releases and tell you the wording that you need to say so that nobody gets the news before you, somebody else gets it. So he's just really great about doing that. And it's very exciting. So Tori got their designation on January 12th of 2018. And now what Tori has to do is they have to make sure that the lights continue to stay in line with what the outdoor ordinance line says. And then you have to do an annual report. And so our annual report is going to be due in October of this year. Once you get designated, they give you a year. And then you have to, every year you have to submit one. And you can see examples of the annual report online too. So I just have been looking at the Capitol Reef annual report to get an idea of what it is we might be doing. So like this, I get to put this on my annual report. So thank you very much. And then what I'm hoping, I kind of have this big picture of what I hope will happen, and I have no idea how many years it will take. But maybe some of you are aware that last year there was a dark sky reserve that was designated in the Ketchum, Idaho area. And I don't know exactly what dark sky reserve means, but I know it means a lot of land, a lot of space. And this section of the United States that we're lucky enough to live in is one of the only places in the whole country that still has the capability of becoming one of these dark sky reserves. Because like 80% of the people in the world live in a place that's so bright that you can't walk up the door and see the Milky Way, and we can't. So what I hope we can do is get a dark sky reserve that goes from low to Hanksville, all the Wayne County, and then over Highway 12 to Boulder and Escalante. Because I know people in Escalante are interested in that too. But I know it'll take time, and I know we just need to just keep talking to people and convince them that this heritage that we've got, that all of our ancestors grew up with, it's there for us to enjoy, but also for the future generations. So I'm just thinking about all those little kids that I really want them to be able to look out and see Orion and the Milky Way and see a shooting star and see something more up there than the moon, which is basically what you can see in the moon. So, that's it.
My question, could you take it back to that one illustration for people who come later?
Okay, let me.
About the outdoor light with the hand.
Yes, yes.
Flare hand, yeah. And the difference in the, like, the Torrey streetlights before.
Yeah. Okay, so what we were saying is that a lot of people are worried that if you have to change your lights to these downward shielded lights, that it's not going to be safe in the yard. So you know when you're driving west into the sunset, and you have to put your hand up in front of your face so you can see where you're going. This picture is kind of that idea. This is somebody's backyard, and that's a pretty typical exterior light with the glare that actually creates these deep shadows that you can't see what's going on out there, because your eyes, the human eye, just cannot comprehend what's going on between the contrast of the bright and the dark. So the next one, somebody's put their hand up in front of it, and it's the same picture, but now you can see that there's somebody standing there, because the glare is out of your eyes, and your brain can understand what you're actually seeing. Then this is, we put up a sample light in Torrey, and this is the sample light, and these are the lights that, all of these lights are replaced, this is not replaced, this is a private light. So people got a chance to see what the lights were gonna look like. So here is the high pressure sodium kind of security light. And you can see the light trespass onto the neighbor's building and up into the sky. And this is a light of just all the magic. Is that what you wanted to do?
Yes, thank you very much.
Questions? Anybody? Okay.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Mary. That was very nice.
Okay, thank you, Mary, for that presentation. Our next item on the agenda is staff reports.
Staff has two things tonight, one very brief. Peg, I passed these out. Can you display the screen? And so the first one I'll kind of deal with summarily. The town council in March asked that the planning commission begin the process of sort of an expanded economic development, however the word is, or opportunity, let's put it that way, under either an expanded definition of light manufacturing and what zone it could happen in, because right now it's going to happen in commercial. We have such limited commercial. And then the other thing is like the definition of home occupation. I looked at it and thought maybe there's some opportunities there. But however it all comes down, I just want to get it on the agenda because the town council has mandated that, and then we start the process. I have nothing to give you yet, but I wanted to start it to the process of saying, okay, what ordinance could we start to massage? What could we look at by way of an amendment to say, and so just sort of, maybe the best way to approach that is to throw a couple of examples. The Robeson / Sugarloaf Farms, 400 acres down in Lower Boulder, for example, they have extremely state-of-the-art shops, for example, cabinetry, I mean, all this stuff. And so would they be allowed to open a cabinet shop and employ two people under our ordinances? There was talk that they may want to build a tiny house plant down there and build some tiny houses and employ four people or whatever. Would they be allowed to do that under our light manufacturing ordinance right now? No. So how would you go about opening up those opportunities? And, you know, we've had people out here, John Brandt one time last year was saying, you couldn't even be a welder and have one employee here on 10 acres and open a little welding shop, or what about what Locke used to do down there? Was it legal? So if we're going to keep young families here, I think that the mayor's thought and the town council's thought is, what economic opportunities are we going to provide them to have a little small business? Like, what about repair? What about auto repair? What about appliance repair? How would you do that in, and in what zone could you do it? And so these are all the questions. And obviously, you could look at areas and you could say, well, let's rezone more commercial. Does that mean I got to go buy an expensive piece of property on Highway 12 or wherever you rezone a commercial but only do it there? And does that really make sense? And is that, and do you want to be a commercial strip zone town like you so often see and everything else is residential? Or do you want to do some disbursement of these businesses? I mean, and is it by employee per acre? Is it, I mean, just so many questions to be addressed. So this is going to be one that is going to just have to go through the process a bunch and look at alternatives, get all your ideas, the town's ideas. But I think opening up economic opportunity that is not just tourist related is important to the future of the town.
Question? Mm-hmm. So what's the title? Is this going to be a discussion about zoning changes or uses within zonings?
All of the above. I mean, everything's got to be on the table to talk about so that you can get your arms around understanding it and what's the best template for the growth of the town, the growth of economic opportunity for younger families that want to stay here. And so I don't have any answers, but
okay. So the appropriate take is a separate standalone ordinance that's going to address all of this?
Well, it'll eventually, yeah, it'll have to be an amendment to the zoning ordinance, and it would be in the form of expansion of zones, expansion of uses in zone, like light manufacturing, expansion of the definition of light manufacturing, potentially expansion of the definition of home occupation. And those are just things I found out in a quick thought about and run through. And so there are probably other ways. But I guess what I should start doing is feeding you parts of the ordinance that might make sense to look at and then deciding how you want to proceed.
And do we have sort of a working title, or does the town council for this sort of project?
I think what Steve kind of called it was economic opportunity for residents that want to, you know, have a business on their property. So I think we should just kind of call it the Economic Opportunity Initiative, and then we'll kind of refine it from there and see how you want to proceed with it. Anything else on that? Okay. I think this one's going to take a while, and, you know, yeah. Just go through it. This one should not take a while. This one is, this comes directly from the town council. Had a very good discussion last Thursday on it. Steve, I actually brought this one up, although, just so you know, as the zoning administrator, I've kind of set a thing here that I'm not going to initiate any petitions for ordinance or whatever. If I have an idea, I'm going to take it either through you or through Steve. Steve's the major elected official here. And if he thinks it's a good idea, then we'll pursue it. If he doesn't, then so be it. But I'm not the initiator. I'm the guy who says the application is complete. And then the grunt. This particular ordinance, I don't see anybody that was here during the Fox Grove subdivision difficulties. Anyway, for those that, and I don't want to come back, that was Ben, but it took a long time, and it took an unnecessarily long time, and it pointed out some things that were really, in the ordinance, that were really weaknesses. So this is a plug-em. It's a two-part thing. I did this with the town council on Thursday night, so
Curtis, do you need the thing back on? The document thing?
I don't know. I think there's enough copies out there, and there's such short language. Anybody else need a copy of this?
Reasonable lessons?
Basically, I can summarize this pretty quickly. The first one is, the problem is that when this ordinance was written in 2008, this ordinance was revised, what it said was, it just quoted state statute, and it said that the Department of Environmental Quality, basically through its subsidiary, Southwest Health, or up in North, it's a different part. But anyway, through those health departments, they are the Culinary Water Authority, and they determine the, quote, feasibility of water to a subdivision. Okay, so you write a letter to Southwest Health, and they write someone back, and they say, yeah, it's feasible, you know. And Boulder, you know, I've called them, well, yeah, Boulder Farms did. We've approved, we test the water, we approved it. It's a public water system, and we know we have wells, and we, you know, we approve well drilling and well drilling and all of this stuff. So, and then the aquifer is sound, as far as we know. That's the end of their duties. So how do we then make sure we're not subdividing dry lots? And here's the potential liability that a town faces if it doesn't round out this ordinance and take it further than what was taken in 2008. And that is, let's say that you have a four-lot subdivision. And I buy one of those lots. And there's no provision for water there, but I don't know that. I think, well, it says all the necessary services and all of this stuff, and so, okay, yeah, we went through all these hoops and we provided all this. But then that subdivider never provided water. And Boulder Farmstead Water has 55 connections left. So I give this to my grandkids. 15, 20 years from now, they come and they apply for a building permit. And they say, and then they are told, well, you have to have water. Can't get, and that's very clear on the ordinance. You have to have water to get a building permit. And Southwest Health will require that. You can't flush toilets. And so, well, okay, where do I get the water? I just want to call Southwest. My grandkid does. And they say, we're out. We have no more connections, sorry. And so then they call the state of Utah and say, we hear you can drill a well in Boulder.
oh yeah, you used to be able to do that. We closed that basin, about 5 years ago. And this is one of the only open basins, one of the few open basins left in the state of Utah. You couldn't get a new water right in Washington County to save your life. It just does not exist. In 1932, the state of Utah passed legislation saying you will adjudicate every drop of water and who owns it in this state within this 50-year period. That adjudication went all through the courts. They created the Utah State Engineer's Office to manage it. You can find the files online, every drop of water, who owns it, and how much they own. So that adjudication was closed 50 years later in the 80s. And so the only way you can still get water is to live in a place like this where the base is open, because the state engineer still has some water in reserve that they own, the state owns, and they're willing to allocate it in a few places. But Kanab, I don't know about Torrey, but it's because of our Navajo aquifer and our small population, and we're next to Boulder Mountain, the recharge area and everything, we're still an open basin. But that could close any day. You get a new state engineer, and on a whim, you say, no, basins are closed. So then we are with little water. So then the question becomes, and I'm not saying this is a slam dunk for my grandkid, but I would hate to defend it on the part of the town. You know, when it comes down to, well, what are my damages? My damages are you buy that lot back, and you buy it back at current prices 20 years later because you subdivided and put your stamp on this subdivision saying all the necessary services were provided. So that's a big risk that the town just doesn't need to take. And so that's the loophole that Part A of this means to correct. On the second page is not a loophole, but it's just a common way of doing things, and it's basically bonding for infrastructure. Well, anybody who's ever tried to get a surety bond knows that it's a very complicated process, et cetera, et cetera. And the people that issue surety bonds, as we found out in 2008, who was that XYZ surety bond company, whatever, that stood behind this and so forth? So right now, the way our ordinance reads, you get your preliminary plat approval, then you go through final plat approval, then you start selling lots. Well, while you're selling those lots, you have a year to build out that infrastructure, and you put a bond saying you'll do that. Okay, halfway through, you know, you sold three or four lots, and then you went to Vegas, and then you ran out of money, and you just say, well, I can't do it. And so now the lot owners are going, wait a minute, we still have that water connection we paid for, we don't have the 8-inch lines, we don't have the fire hydrants, we don't have the road, we don't have anything, that we were supposed to get with this. And that's not the town's fault. The town bonded correctly, and everybody can say, well, did you check out that bonding company? They went broke, you know? So were we negligent in not doing that? Or the town can go ahead and sue on the bond. And bonding companies don't just go, oh yeah, okay, here's your money. You gotta sue them on the bond, you gotta go through all these hoops, and then, okay, they're gonna pay up. Then you gotta go build it. You know, I mean, what staff do we have to go finish a subdivision? And, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a very easy answer to this, and this is what a lot of smaller towns have adopted that don't have construction inspectors, don't have bonding attorneys. I mean, Salt Lake County has three attorneys in the county attorney's office do nothing but bonds. So we're not in that position. So what I suggest we adopt with, like Springdale was. They approve the preliminary plat, and they approve it with conditions. And those conditions can be stated on the plat or in the form of a development agreement. I prefer, rather than cluttering up the plat, I prefer a development agreement as an exhibit A to the plat. So you've got a preliminary plat. You said, yep, we're going to approve this. You meet all the code provisions, da-da-da-da. But you have a letter from Randy Catmull saying you're going to hook up to Boulder Farmstead Water. And so we want assurance you're actually going to do that, because those of you know it has it. You get the letter, and then you don't actually go follow through and pay the money. So in the development agreement, it says you're going to either, your choice, do you want to buy, you know, however big the subdivision is, let's say it's a four lot subdivision. No, let's make it eight. I don't want to pick on it. It's an eight lot subdivision, so you have a deal with Bolton Farmstead. You bought eight connections under whatever terms they do. And their terms are like cash up front. Well, that's their call. I mean, we can't do it. Most towns will just sell you the meter and then guarantee the water because they own the municipal system. But we don't have that situation. Or that subdivider comes in and says, I have 4 acre feet of water. I have eight lots under the state law. It's 0.45 acre-feet of water per law for culinary only. Now, irrigation is different. You have some irrigation rights, you want one, whatever. But that's the minimum you've got. So let's just round it up to a half an acre-foot. So 4 acre-feet of proven underground water rights will give me a half acre-foot per lot. And then what I do, then I say, okay, I own that. I can prove it. Curtis, you're the zoning administrator. Curtis, okay, I give you the proof as you're proving that. So in the development agreement, then it says, prior to the final plat being filed and recorded, you will dedicate and go through the state and change a point of diversion or however you want to do it to the well or dedicate it to the lot or do it, you know, per lot. We got to figure the mechanics out of that, but it can be done easily. And so then now you've taken that and you've split it up and you've, every one of those has a half an acre foot culinary water is covered. And and then if there's fire hydrants needed, they put in fire hydrants. If there's water lines needed, if the road situation, it describes how wide the road will be, where it will be run. It's all on the cut sheets. The town, it's provided in there that if you're going to do a subdivision, the town's entitled to hire its own engineer, and then your engineer has to work with that engineer. And so we have a nice smooth process. And the applicant has to pay for our engineer too. And that's all towns do that. So basically, then we just go ahead and get all that infrastructure done. No lots have been sold. That's the key to this whole deal. And so since no lots have been sold, no harm, no foul. That guy goes broke halfway through, then he sells the subdivision to somebody and they can fix it or it can lay fallow or it can do whatever. But we have no liability, potential liability to any owners or anybody coming after us to finish something. Then he carries through, our engineer signs off, they do a final inspection, and then Steve signs that final plat. We sign off on that agreement, everything is stamped and recorded, then you sell lots. And that's a much cleaner way to approach this. So I'm going to recommend that, I want to mess around just a little bit with the land here, but not very much. I mean, just what I described is all we're going to do. So I'm going to suggest you go ahead and schedule for a public hearing. This is complete enough to do your public hearing and just get this one kind of pushed along. There's not a lot of policy considerations involved unless you have some concerns. So
we'll put that on upcoming business.
You want
to put that on upcoming business?
Yeah, I would just go ahead and when you talk later, if you feel like you can go ahead and have a public hearing. And you don't have to have, when you schedule a public hearing, you do not need anything more than the general principles involved. I mean, what I've described is enough. And then I will look this over and kind of get back to you. And, you know, we'll have plenty of time to massage a little bit of language or maybe drop this into a little separate section. I'm not sure yet. Just want it to read real clear.
Okay. Do we need a motion to move it to public hearing then?
I don't think you'd need. No.
Okay.
Just.
Okay.
Well, you will eventually if you decide to have one, yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, just to schedule a public hearing, you don't need a motion. You just decide.
Okay. I'll be on there.
Okay. So we can deal with that business right now instead of later.
Yeah, if you want to. If you're comfortable, go ahead and...
Okay. So before we make that decision, Perry, are you on the line?
I am. Hello.
Hi there. All right, so we have Perry Tancredi joining us by phone, and we've also had Marion Johnson, right, join us on the commission table. Okay, so this ordinance to require culinary water for lots and an alternate means of infrastructure construction. Does anyone have any comments on that? In the commission? Huh? Perry? Okay, so I think, you know, I read this over. I'd say move it forward to a public hearing in our next meeting in May. Okay, great. All right, so I think we can move to the next agenda item. Is that all you have for us?
That's it.
Okay. So the next agenda item we have tonight is our public hearing on residential short-term rental ordinance. Before we open that, I just wanted to see if anybody on the commission had any comments on that last draft that we got before we go to public. No?
I don't.
Okay, I just want to look at my notes. I did have one question, and it's on page 2, it's item 3.3, and it says that any lot that has been in use as an RSTR over the previous 12 months and can prove such, et cetera, et cetera. Are we going to have a date in there that clarifies what that previous 12 months means? Or because to me it's not clear whether it is now, or if it's in the future when somebody looks at that part, are they thinking the previous 12 months that date?
The way that would, the ordinance is just a draft now, so
okay.
12 months would be from the date that Steve signed it, the town signed it, if they signed it.
Okay.
Or, you know, whatever happens there. So that would be your trigger date.
Okay. And that is all I have. Anything else? Okay, so we'll go ahead and close the commission meeting and open the public hearing on the residential short-term rental ordinance.
Motions for that.
Okay, come on.
Make a motion that we close the regular meeting and open the public hearing.
Second it.
Okay, so the meeting is now closed. Public hearing is now open.
Oh, take a vote.
Oh, we need to vote. Aye.
Aye.
Okay, so that's Matt Cochran, aye.
I'm just putting.
Marian Johnson, aye. Justin Muse, aye. Elizabeth Julian, aye.
Perry, aye.
Perry?
I was muted, aye. Sorry.
He's done. Off mute. All right, now we're open for public hearing. So, comments from anyone?
I'm sorry, I know I haven't read your draft, but I understand there's some limitations that this might address.
Could you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry, I'm Tina Carlson.
Thank you.
I'm actually going to read an email that Scotty Mitchell sent, and I'm happy to hand it over also. But, so, that's okay. I'm going to do that. Thank you, Planning Commission, for all the time and effort you put into for the community. Airbnbs have been such a source of good and bad. I think once you limited them to a primary resident you have solved the problem of community being taken over by Airbnbs. Beyond that, I think that the pros far outweigh the cons, and don't believe that there should be limitations on older residents renting out part of their primary residence in any way. I think on this issue, the town plan has become restrictive in nature, looking for how to restrict instead of how to enable. So as the pros, Airbnb enables those of us who live here to help make ends meet, or perhaps meet mortgage payments that would enable one to stay here. Places are needed for tourists to stay, and Airbnb revenues would all stay here in town. When the lodge fills up, as it often does, those tourists that want to an upscale place to stay go to Escalante or Torrid. Staying here, they are also doing dropping money into local restaurants and stores, and they also pay local tourist tax. That is a plus. Were I to stay in Boulder, I could not make ends meet in older age if I couldn't use my house as an asset. And as I want to sell to someone who will live here, the prospect of helping to pay for the house with an Airbnb makes it more likely for someone who wants to live here to be able to buy. I heartily resent someone restricting my ability to use my own house my primary dwelling that my ex and I built, as there was not housing in Boulder when we came. And no, a long-term rental is not going to pay the bills, nor do I want a roommate. And I want to have guests when I want. So short-term rentals is the only way. I would imagine that applies to others as well. Providing the home-like experience to travelers is also a plus. I'm staying now in an Airbnb. Its owner lives here. I can't imagine having to travel, only staying in hotels. Who among you has not enjoyed that experience? So what are the cons? More cars, more strangers. I'm sorry, but Boulder is a tourist destination. The town can decline or stagnate or grow. Those seem to be the choices. Subdivisions cause more cars too, and hotel guests often wander around town. I often have strangers wandering down my lane from Circle Cliffs, and that's just fine. I'm glad when Candace and Corey have business. I've not heard of any acts of violence attributed to Airbnb people in Wayne County or Garfield County. I feel there's an overreaction due to real damage that Airbnbs have caused in some places. But the damage is due to buying out the houses, not primary residents renting out part of their homes. And let's look at numbers, really. What are we talking about? How many people would rent out part of their primary residence? I feel this is a storm in a teacup. It also seems totally unfair that those living here in the county can augment their income, but we in town can't. So please do not restrict us residents as being able to from being able to prosper. I cannot think of anyone offhand who would rent to a local long term if they were not allowed to have an Airbnb. The need for housing should not be reason for restricting one's ability to have short-term rentals in primary residence. Nor should home owners feel obligated to have a long-term rental because housing is scarce. Housing has been scarce in Boulder for decades, and it should be the individual homeowner's choice to provide housing. Last sentence. It seems a win-win situation to me. Local people in our local economy would be helped. Change is inevitable, and this is benign. I think it would actually benefit the community to aid those living here. Thank you, Sky. I just would like to follow up on this, and that is that property prices are horrible here as far as somebody coming in and moving in and trying to pay for without a job, basically. If they come in here and they're actually working for someone in town, that pay would never allow them necessarily to actually purchase property, and probably rent would be hard too. So I really think we need to consider the fact that we want to be a diverse community, and we want younger people and older people, and we want, you know, a lot of people of different economic backgrounds. If this is something that can help people, I also agree that it shouldn't be over-regulated. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Tina, would you mind leaving the email copy?
Oh, yeah.
For our notes? Thank you, ma'am.
Can we move the phone, please, to the podium?
Yeah, you bet. Okay.
Where's the mic?
I turned it up. Hi, anyone else?
And you can probably clarify some of this in your discussion. Under three, where you're on the limitation, Steve Cox, by the way, each of the three areas will be allowed, and you have a 15% of total residents. So, and maybe discuss this, how many would that actually be? And then if you grandfather some in, is that included in the 15%? And how many of those are there? So I'm a little unclear on numbers that we're dealing with right now. So maybe that'll be something you've talked about and can just clarify in your discussion. And then going back to our ADU ordinance, number 7 on our, the one we just passed not too long ago, says an ADU may not be used as a residential short-term rental or any form of transient lodging where the occupancy is less than 30 days unless said short-term use is authorized by subsequent ordinance, in which case those terms and conditions will apply. I couldn't exactly figure out if we are changing that now, because according to the ADU ordinance, it was very clear that they're not to be used. But now are we thinking of allowing those to be used? And if so, where is that language? Because the two probably should match up a little bit. We've said we're not going to unless a new ordinance changes it. Where is that? So those are just a couple, I guess, clarifying things that probably will come up in your discussion. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve. Anyone else? Okay. Oh, thank you.
I'm Paul Gove, and I live in the Draw, which is not officially a town. And I have not been involved in much of the discussion that's been going on. I'm a sociologist. I've worked in community areas for a long time. I know something about how they evolve. And all I want to say is I've seen a number of towns this size, a little bigger, who have just moved into being Airbnb places, and I just encourage you to go through and try to keep the community as a viable, functional community. And I very much applaud the efforts you do. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, any other comments?
I'm Vicki Schaus. I live in Lower Boulder. And I just want to also commend the planning board for all their minute, it seems like, going over this for months now. And I've read it over as much as I can and absorbed as much as I can. And I'd like to say I agree with probably 99% of it. I have sympathy for people who need to rent places, who own a primary residence and want to do Airbnbs. I sympathize with that. But on the other hand, I really appreciate the limitations that you've put on it. I think it's reasonable, and for people who have enough money usually to own their own home and pay taxes, and they usually, with budgeting, not going to Europe each year or whatever, can afford to stay there without having short-term rental. On the other hand, I am very much for long-term rentals. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Cookie. Any other comments?
Steve Johnson, I live in Upper Boulder. I just have a couple questions. When I looked through the proposal, it seemed very restrictive, and I understand the reasons for that. So I have three questions. Would a proposal like this becoming an ordinance, would it withstand a legal challenge? Second, for someone who is not a resident, does not live in the home, but they've been operating their structure here as an Airbnb for a couple of years, how does this proposal affect them? Mm-hmm. Are they going to be grandfathered in or just told, you're out of business? And third, what if somebody has a second home, a second structure on their property, but not their primary residence? For example, it might be a second home on a single lot or an adjacent lot. How would this proposal affect, the short-term rental of the home that they do not occupy as a primary residence? Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Okay, any other comments? All right, I move to close the public hearing.
Second that.
All right. And we will reopen the commission general meeting and open a discussion up to the commission on the ordinance, the public comments, before proceeding to a vote.
Could you all vote on that?
On what part? Reopening the...
Yeah. Moving, open, close, open.
We need to move to open. Okay. So would someone like to move to open the general meeting?
I move to open the work of the general. Is it the working meeting? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or just regular meeting.
The regular meeting.
Second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Perry?
Yep.
Okay. Everyone's in favor. Great. All right, so who wants to go first?
I'll start, I guess.
Okay.
So first overview. I feel like we've been working on this for a good long time now. And personally, I feel like we've struck a really good balance between allowing homeowners, full-time people here, to have a chance to, make get some opportunity off short-term rental, as well as protect the residential communities from not becoming commercial areas. And we've really followed what I feel is in the sort of the outlook of the general plan. And we've listened to many public comments at this point and talked to people who may not show up for these meetings as well. And so I'm pretty happy with everything as is. That said, I think there does need to be some clarity on what Steve asked, and then we should answer Steve's questions as well. Did I get your name right?
Yeah.
So, Perry, yeah, I was wondering, I sort of want to direct it to Perry on the ADU and short-term rental, because you seem most clear on this part.
I'm happy to address that. So,
thanks.
The question was about the ADU, or the part of the ADU, the language in the ADU ordinance that specifies that things about the use of the group, residential short-term rental use. And that was put there specifically with the idea that we would be, at a later date, allowing it in this ordinance. What we were trying to avoid was a situation where we would allow ADUs to be built, and in the time between then and the RSDR ordinance, that there might be a proliferation of short-term rentals. So the intent is for this ordinance to supersede that language, and we can make that more clear either in this ordinance or if we need to update the other ordinance, but that's the intent. Part of the thought there was that if we restrict if we restrict residential short rentals to a primary residence, it won't necessarily reduce the number of rentals because someone with an ADU could just move into their ADU and rent out their primary residence. The other thinking was that the intent here is to actually make ADUs more available for things like increased income for residents, then it makes sense that a resident here might have an ADU that they rent out in order to augment their income while they're living here. And, you know, the intent is not to have absentee rentals. So in order to help residents benefit from this, they need to have a second dwelling to rent out. So that's the intent and that's the reasoning behind it.
So is our language clear on that?
Here's what I would suggest. I agree with Steve, it's not clear enough, and I'll take responsibility for that. So refer to paragraph 5B, 2II, and I would suggest a sentence in there, where two dwellings exist, the owner may use the primary residence or the ADU as an RSTR and shall provide a statement of how owner occupancy and RSTR occupancy will be apportioned, semicolon. In no event shall two dwellings on a lot be occupied by RSTR guests simultaneously. So in other words, it's rather than just saying you go to the legislation, what you're going to use at first representative, yes, you can use either one, and that's what I understand that you wanted, so that's why I put it in here. But I think that clears it up more. And the only thing I could even put, notwithstanding the provision on ordinance number 2018-4, which is the ordinance, and cite the provision. If you want it that clear, but I can clear that up.
Thank you.
I think it's probably a good idea to add clarity to it.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that? Is that still your position?
Yes. And then it was last meeting that we changed from we had originally designated four possible RSTRs in each of the three zones, upper, middle, and lower Boulder. And I can't remember why we changed it to a percentage. It's somewhat comparable, but we can't add it up to specific numbers, but it depends sort of, we're gonna look into the amount of...
the population.
Yeah, the population density of those areas, so it was equitable, which is why we moved it to a percent. As opposed to specific.
Unless arbitrary, say that just this zone gets four, this one gets four, because the development in each zone could change.
And I think, at least from the last discussion, we thought that when it originally was, it was four per, and I think we realized that this would keep it between two to four in each one based on it, but that we'd actually have to, and I think it was Perry that brought this up, but I'm not sure, you know, those numbers actually have to be collected.
So is that additional ones? Because there will be some that are grandfathered in. So in the 15%, is that every all of them?
We have, well, we have language further on in here that addresses that.
Right.
Yeah, maybe I just do not
understand.
I'd like to address that for a second. The options are to either include all of them, exclude all of them, or that I think the language now is to exclude all of them so that the four would be additional. Or what I'm in favor of is for those that can be conforming, you know, if they need to put in a sign and put in a fire extinguisher, if it doesn't represent a hardship for those to conform, then we include them. For those that are non-conforming, let's say because the owner did not, if the owner didn't have a primary residence in town or some other, something else that represents a hardship, maybe the square footage doesn't match, then those would not count towards the total.
And that was our discussion last month, correct? And we did take a vote. And
we got added.
We had majority. It wasn't unanimous, right? And where was it added?
It's 3.
Well, did we take a vote on... I remember it as I recommended that at the end of the meeting after we had taken the initial vote.
Okay.
I think we were voting on the first two options, not without considering the third.
Well, we have the Curtis redrafted part of that. I can't stick. I'm trying to figure out what section it is.
It's 3-3.
3-3. So let's, can you read that?
Okay. Any lot that has been in use as an RSTR over the previous 12 months, that's from the date this is signed, and can prove such RSTR usage by providing proof of payment of sales and use tax to the Utah State Tax Commission, together with a current sales tax license therefrom, shall not be counted in the quota and shall be entitled to continue said use, so long as the owner of the lot obtains a CUP and complies with this ordinance. But I thought you said that if they can comply, they will be counted in the quota. If they can't comply, then they won't be counted in the quota.
Yeah, so that language as it is now does not address non-conforming uses or uses that can't comply.
Right, so if they comply, it counts towards the 15% quota. If they can't comply,
yeah.
We're going to grandfather them in.
I misunderstood. Because as far as I was concerned, I thought we were saying, okay, as far as your quota goes, and I made it pretty stiff test, because some of these people may not be paying sales tax, and that makes them illegal anyway, so they don't have to count. But if they're a legal non-conforming use, and they've been abiding by state law and so forth, then what you said is, I think, don't count them in the quota, but they still have to comply with the ordinance. They still have to come in and get a conditional use permit, and they still have to go through the list of things, and they still have to make sure their fire safety, their fire pit, and those are not hardships to them to bring them into compliance on that, and their fire extinguishers, and to have a manager somewhere that can handle things, and we don't really have, like, they have to go structurally rebuild the house or anything. It's just they have to do these things that are pretty easy to comply with, and they're reasonable. So that's why that's what I thought you were asking for. Everybody complies, except if you're a legal RSTR, a non-compliant legal one, as of the date this ordinance is signed, then you don't count in the quota particularly, because then maybe it's not fair to the other people in the zone or something. I thought that's what it meant.
And that makes more sense to me.
That is the third option that I articulated it.
So let's clarify then what we want that to say, right? Perry, I'm going to ask you to do that.
I think that's kind of what I just said, I think is what it says right now.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'll use an example. Let's say we have, in one of the zones, we have 3 existing rentals. One of those can comply because of, they meet the residential requirements. It's not a hardship to meet all the other requirements, and they pay taxes and all that.
Yeah.
That use would be one towards the quota. The other two are legal uses but non-compliant. For whatever reason, it would be a hardship for them to become compliant, whether it's because of residential use requirements or square footage or whatever. They still are required to follow or start to pay tax. They just wouldn't count towards the quota.
Because they're likely
one
not.
Yeah, that would be the one big red. Sorry. Yeah. Because if they're a non-resident, but they're legal, non-compliant, then that would be the one area of the CUP that they couldn't meet, but
right.
They probably had to,
we would still want them to pay tax, though, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it just,
so they would do everything.
The residency requirement.
Yeah. It's everything that we could require. Maybe not the CUP, but they wouldn't count for
they would not count towards the quota. But if they were, they were complying and they were resident and they're existing now, then they would count towards the quota, right?
Correct.
Okay, so what you want? Okay, so.
I mean, we can vote on that if we need to.
You run through that again for me.
Yeah.
Because the language that's in here seems to fit pretty well the one situation, right?
Yeah.
On 3A3, that they've been doing all the necessary things, so they're not part of the quota, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the other one situation. What isn't in here, I guess?
I think it would be the residential piece of it. If they are if it's their primary residence, then we would include them in the quota. If they can comply with everything except for that part, then it would not be included in the quota. Is that how you understand? Is that how you're presenting that, Perry?
Yes.
Yeah. Is that clear? And that would require a little bit of language change here.
Yes, yes. And just so I'm clear, let's say that Sugarloaf Farms comes and qualifies for an application for a conditional use permit for a guest ranch. They're gone from the quota, right?
That was part of our discussion, that if it's a guest ranch, it's not an RSTR.
Right, and that would be, that way does it work under our ordinance?
Mm-hmm. Because we do have that option.
B&B, if they have the proper condition use for a B&B, a guest ranch, something else.
It does not.
Okay.
It does not go into the quota.
Right, and that's the way this would work now, but I just wanted to make sure that we're on the same page here.
And I believe
last... So I need some language on this quota, resident, non-resident, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
So I don't know if this is resident, so I guess I'm confused on it. In the last meeting, and this got brought up, I think it was during the public comment period at the end of the last one, but... and Perry, I think you were the one that worded it, was something about... So the people that currently have them but are... If they take up all the quota, then I don't even know what I'm saying. I just think I need to read it when it's written correctly.
Okay.
Because I think I'm just going in a circle around the language.
I'm going to kind of guess that if the range applies for the, or I know where they have it, Donna said they did, but anyway, it would be logical. If they did that, I doubt if we're going to have the people have paid sales tax in the last 12 months when this thing is signed by the mayor. We may not have two in the whole town.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm going to say this, it's not going to be a huge problem. But I don't know whether those two are residents or not residents. So we'll clear that up.
Okay, and I'm going to try and answer some of Steve's questions, but number one, would it withstand a legal challenge? You know, that we've been working with Curtis on that. And it's real, I think it's complicated. In the Airbnb world, everything's changing so fast, but we're doing the best we can with that at the moment, I'd say.
Using current case law?
Yeah.
We're doing our best to comply with the case, the defining case on this issue in the Utah Supreme Court, or the Utah Court of Appeals. And so, saying something will stand up to a legal challenge is never black and white, but we're doing our best to comply with that case.
And hopefully that last discussion answered more or less your second question. And the third about, I wasn't quite clear on your question, if you have a primary dwelling and an ADU, we would call it now, a second residence on the property, what was the question about that?
If you had two lots.
For two lots, okay.
Right, so they're next to each other.
And that's a good question. If you have your primary residence on one lot and you own an adjacent lot, how is that, how would that play in? And I think that's a really realistic scenario. As it stands right now, it would be no.
I drew a list marker and consolidated two lots and called one of them an ADU and one of them
What in the current ordinance would prevent you from, I understand that the current ordinance says if you're a resident, you can essentially offer one RSDR.
Yeah.
But if you have two lots, what would prevent you from living in one and renting out the other?
And that makes the most sense. Even though that they're platted as two separate lots, you're still a primary residence. And I would agree with that. There's the disadvantage of joining your lots together is for future investment, because then you're going to have to separate them again.
Right, and I think if they came in for a CUP and said, hey, we're calling this an ADU, and there's a problem, it's like, really, do we care?
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
And I don't see, is there anything in the current ordinance that would prevent that?
Let's look at it really quick, because as I recall...
Just that you're only allowed to have one RSDR.
Yeah, one per lot.
And so maybe just one per...
It's very difficult to erase that distinction, because then you kind of blow the whole deal up. Because then how do you define it?
Right.
Can we look at 4A2? It states that be the owner of the lot and... occupy the lot for a minimum of 182 days per year, and under 3, not use the lot as an RSTR in excess of 100. So I think that
prevents it
because it's speaking specifically to the lot.
Right. Maybe instead of B lot, maybe we say A lot within town limits. Because what we want is for them to be for residents, but we don't necessarily care for the living what they're renting out.
And that might do it if Curtis thinks that language would work. Because the other part that we have is that you can only have one.
Yeah, I think my original answer was the one that fit the ordinance. If it's two lots, anyone can re-subdivide later, but it's, you know, if it's two lots, it would just, to fit this ordinance, you make it one lot. Then it's an ADU.
You might not be able to, though, re-subdivide it. Like, if you were to look at, let's say it's two adjacent lots up in the north end of the subdivision, right? Those are 1 acre lots currently, and if they put them together, they won't be able to put them back into 2 1-acre lots.
I don't know whether they can or not, because it's zoned for 1 acre lots. So
that's true.
Well, another hypothetical is your adjacent lot already has an ADU. Mm-hmm. So if you pull it all into one lot, now you have two homes plus an ADU. And that could happen.
Yeah.
You just can't take care of everything in an ordinance. It's just impossible. I don't think there's any way to blow up the definition of a lot. Otherwise, you kind of have to go through the whole thing and, well, what are you dealing with? And then if you try to describe it as two lots, well, I don't know. I think it would get very difficult.
Did you have something to add?
Let's define what we intend. The intention is that if you're a resident of Boulder, you can have one unit to rent out. I don't think we care where you live and where the lot is, as long as they look at Boulder. Is that right?
I would have to modify the language. If that were the issue, then, because you're supposed to occupy the lot for 182 days a year,
I know the language as it stands now, so incorporate that, but I want to ask the commission whether or not that is our intention.
So, to just use Steve's property as the example, right? So, right, currently he lives in one lot that is a 1 acre lot, and the adjacent lot is his mother-in-law's, and she's currently living in that home. If at some point she either moves into their home, or she's no longer living, what are they able to do with their other house? Is that, just to use it as really specific, you know, like it is, it's not one house. And on that particular two lots, there are no additional dwellings. Right. Is that correct? It's just each lot has one dwelling, and it's what happens when one home is the primary for everyone that lives here and the other home. What is that what you're asking, Steve?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
And I agree. I would prefer that we clean that language up so that...
To support it.
Because I think that in Boulder, we have a lot of that in our family situations, that they are adjacent lots, and when a family member moves on and you inherit that, that's going to be an issue across the board. So
what if it was not even like, I don't even know the wording wise, but you know.
That's just you guys' wording.
Yeah, I know.
That's perfect. That's good.
You want to eliminate the days? Or?
No.
We still want someone to be a resident of Boulder.
Right.
And so what I think we want to do is just say that requirement does not have to be on the lot that you rent. That requirement means because that you're a resident of Boulder for that many days on lot.
So Boulder is your primary residence as reflected in the records of Garfield County Treasurer and Assessor. And keep going. You can rent out a second residence. And how many takes a year?
You don't need to occupy the... We're not saying that you need to occupy either a lot or the dwelling that you're renting out. I don't think there's a requirement. I don't think we want to make that requirement.
So how do we say that a resident just needs to be a habitant of Boulder for 182 days per year? Right? And not necessarily occupy that lot.
So occupy a lot as opposed to the lot?
That would be a real simple
Yeah.
I'm changing just the article.
That seems to work for me.
How about a third home?
No, because we've limited it to where they can only have one RSTR.
Okay.
Or one CUP, so we've taken care of that. This is just taking care of these adjacent lot issues that are...
We're just talking about occupancy of the lot. A lot.
So right where it says occupy the, what would be if you changed it to of?
I love changes like that.
Me too.
I mean, I think there's a cleaner language way to do than just occupy a lot or be in. Be an inhabitant of Boulder for 180.
You just put a tent up on some random lot.
Okay, so if under that condition, you could rent out the ADU. You could rent out your own house while you leave the ADU for a limit of a certain number of days a year, or another home you own.
On a lot.
You're entitled to one CUP.
Okay.
Yeah, I can fix that.
Thank you, sir. Okay, so we talked about the grandfathered. We talked about 15%, talked about the ADU, covered Steve Johnson's on his item number 3, adjacent lots. The rest were general opinions. Am I correct? All right, so back to the commission. Does anyone have anything else to add?
I still think that, you know, before doing anything, that, and it's similar to what Steve said, it's item 3A. I mean, I know that last time we talked about the percentage, but I still think that to know those actual numbers before anything goes on is important, because at this point it seems pretty arbitrary. And I do, I think I like that it's moving towards that fluctuation of and realistic population density, if that's what the intention is, but to actually know what that number is seems important before it goes any farther to me.
Right, these are 15% compared to 3.5 houses.
Yeah.
Or 3.5 short-term rentals.
Or, you know, yeah.
But we need to have the flexibility that with growth and change. So are you suggesting having something in here that says there will be a survey annually, or?
I don't know. I just think that at this point, you know, for if this ordinance is for our issues that are currently and looking at a projection of so much time, right? And you can use all different things of available lots and available water, you know, to make a prediction. But to have something more than just, I mean, even knowing what the current population density in each of those three areas and what is, to date, what is 15% in each of those is important to me before, you know, voting on something one way or the other, because it's such a gray spot still in the ordinance itself that I don't have confidence even to make an opinion one direction or other on that one point.
Actually, as I listen to you too, I think it's probably, it's a little sad legal challenge. And any time that you can do fact-finding to nail things down, you have buttressed yourself against a challenge. Because these are the kind of ordinances that do get challenged.
Right.
And so I think that that's a good fact-finding mission to how did you arrive at the 15% so that you can support it as having been equitable. And so that would mean surveying each sector that you delineated, 1, 2, 3, going through counting the residences who might qualify, and then isolating what's 15% of that, what's 15% here, what's 15% there.
Right. And are we looking at all residences or just full-time residences?
Yeah.
Primary residences.
Primary residences.
Yeah.
And is that something we could get off a tax record instead of driving around town?
You could. You could. You can get it right off the plat.
Quickest.
Current plats have the tax numbers right on there, and that's you can look at the plat, you can see the lots. You might have to drive around. You could go to the tax commission and see if it has a primary dwelling listed, or you could just use a plat and pull this house on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to determine whether it's primary or not. If it's primary, it gets 40% deduction. It's shown on the as primary on the rolls. Otherwise, if it's not their primary residence, they pay full tilt. And so it'd be a little work. Zoning administrator can do it, but.
I have some, Keith Fulmer got some information from Les Barker, basically spreadsheet information for on that. And I have that in the spreadsheet, and I'm not sure if it has this data, but I think you could probably come up with that.
How current was the run?
As of, say, 6 months ago.
Okay. Would that suffice for good enough data?
Whatever you can isolate out there, and you combine that with a plat, then you can see where everything is, and it shouldn't be too big a job.
Yeah.
I think Elizabeth really wants to do that
one. Field trip.
But for the public, our original intention before the percentage was we divided the three areas, you know, without really looking at it generally equitably, and had said 4. RSTRs in each zone, and so the percentage is trying to hit somewhere close to that. Okay.
Yeah.
So can we get approval to order plots, current plots? Then we can get them electronically.
Sure.
It's yeah.
And unfortunately, they're not available electronically yet in Garfield County. I don't believe.
Oh, I get them. I've done
electronically.
It.
Did you really? How good.
Yeah. And you can actually, you can download it free, but it's only updated, I think Les does it once a year. So if you have some recent development, it won't be there.
I think for our purposes here, if we can get them within a year, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay, so order, so it's the whole Boulder Town
right.
property plan.
Yeah, and she can just email them.
Mm-hmm. So, wow. She.
Who's Les's? I can't remember.
Oh, yeah. I don't remember
either,
but yeah.
It's, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so we'll come up with our number from that data.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if we have a spreadsheet and then we have the plats, it should fall into place. It should. Might still take a little driving.
Okay.
Whoever's still.
What are you doing, all in charge?
I'll ride my bike.
Okay.
At least I'm vulnerable.
Josie, did you feel like your question at the very beginning about the 12 months, the 3A3? Because,
yes.
I mean, I know it got brought up at the very end of that last meeting, and I believe, Perry, it was you that suggested that 12 months, and you were saying from the date of that meeting, although it doesn't read that, I just want to make sure that you felt like it was clarified in the
so the
put on that, because that was another kind of muddied.
The answer that we got was the date from when the ordinance is signed
yeah.
by the mayor, and that was a good enough answer for me,
okay.
if that's how it's going to carry forward.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure it got addressed.
I guess, actually, let's revisit that, because there was concern that there would be a rush to, because this isn't going to be signed immediately. So that's a good point. We did say that it would be from the date of the last meeting. Does anyone have anything else to say on that? Perry?
No, it works for me.
Yeah, I think it works the way it's in there. I just wanted to make sure.
Okay. All right. Anything else?
Do you want to set a date certain?
I don't
think even if it takes this a while to finish up.
I think it looks good the way.
Yeah, I don't have a strong opinion on that either way. I think we've discussed enough that we don't think there's going to be this huge risk of.
Rush, yeah.
Okay. So, given our discussion, and then we want to do some further data collection. Do we want to move forward with a public, let's see, are we ready for the public hearing on this one? We're talking about it, voting, I'm moving this forward to
the town council.
To the town council, right, we just had a public hearing.
Can we do that given with the changes that we've called for and given the ballots?
Yeah, you can report it to the town council with the changes as reflected in the minutes.
Okay.
And also, with the intention that we'll have this data collection in the next month to support the 15%?
Yeah.
That would be good enough?
Or by the next town council.
Yes, prior to the next town council.
Okay, so then I think we're ready if someone wants to move.
Why don't you put somebody in charge of that, just so somebody knows it. However they're going to move it, they're going to move it. Otherwise.
Okay, do we have a volunteer to be in charge of the overseeing the plat and spreadsheet?
Divide and conquer. There's four of them, four different districts.
I would volunteer in a heartbeat, but I have a June 1st meeting of wrapping up the Mesa. I'm just buried with it. I know I have to get to it before June 1st.
We're going to have a spreadsheet to come up with the population.
Right, getting the spreadsheet from Peter.
Well, it's not the population, but it's the number of residences.
So Perry can take that part.
Thank you, Perry.
Thanks, Perry.
And then Peg will be overseeing getting the plat maps for us.
Yep, I will obtain that from the Sparker office.
Exactly, and then that will be supporting information to the spreadsheet, and if you need more information, you'd be able to get it from this. And I think that if it does come out that more work is needed after those two come together, that we can email and support that effort.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so I think we're ready. We could put a motion in order to forward the RSTR ordinance towards the town council.
Okay, so I'd like to make a motion to forward the RSTR draft ordinance to the town council.
With the conditions
that will be present in the minutes for this April meeting.
Conditioned upon the changes as reflected in the minutes being made to the draft.
The conditions, the changes as reflected in the minutes. Blah, blah, blah.
I second it.
Okay.
All in favor?
You should do it.
I'll do a roll call. Okay. We'll start with Elizabeth Julian.
Matt Cochran, aye.
Josie Muse, aye.
Maria Johnson, aye.
Perry, can you vote on the floor?
Perry McCready, aye.
Okay.
That's fine. Can you get that on our agenda?
Yeah.
Public hearing.
Oh, for
the
you guys.
Council?
Do you want to, so you want to schedule your public hearing that night as well? Okay. Okay.
Very good. All right, we're ready to move on to the next.
Congratulations for all the work you guys.
Thank you. I was going to do that, but I didn't want to power it on the back. Okay, so the next item is discuss subdivision ordinance revisions, which we already did under the staff report. So we're moving to review general plan updates and schedule a public hearing for that. Okay, so last month, I sent out the draft and I sent out the supporting spreadsheet. So I think we can just open that to discussion. If anyone on the commission has anything to add, anything that would comment on.
Having been involved with the draft, I don't have any comments. It's all there.
Yes. Okay. No? So we're down to either Harry or Elizabeth have any additional items for the general plan. Elizabeth, a no. Perry?
I'm a no. Yes. Okay.
Excellent. All right, well, I want to thank the revision committee for all the work that they did on this. We had five people. We had Matt Cochran, Tina Carlson,
Josh
Ellis, Daniel Kennedy, and then Peter Benson was the town council liaison. And I mentioned Tina, so thank you all. Very good effort. So that was easy to pass tonight. So let's go ahead, and I think we can do a motion to move this to a public hearing, the general plan revision.
So I'll make a motion to move our general plan update to a public hearing for the month of May, I guess.
I second that.
Elizabeth seconds. All those in favor, we'll do a roll call.
Marion Johnson.
Aye. Josie Muse, aye.
Matt Cochran, aye.
Elizabeth Julian, aye.
Harry Sincrini, aye.
Okay, very good.
Can I ask one question?
Yes, sir.
I thought it was a great job on that. One of the things that we've always been told that we don't have a very good handle on are action items. We set goals, but we don't have action items. And that list you generated was great. I'd love to see that somehow put into a list of action items.
Okay.
Because then the town can budget for some things that we see coming from the general plan, things that maybe need to be done. It doesn't necessarily have, you know, they said put it in your general plan. That was advice we got from, I think, the Rural Planning Group, because your action items should be part of your general plan. But I don't necessarily agree with that. Okay. But I agree that we ought to have a list of things that require our attention as a town council.
Okay.
And so it's priority based as well.
Yeah, and you don't have to prioritize.
We'll let you do that.
As long as, from your discussions, and because I could see going down that spreadsheet, there were some things that were things the town council needs to move on.
Yeah.
And it'd be nice to have a list, and it doesn't have to be exhaustive, mm-hmm. but just enough to give us some guidance on things that we should do as a town council to move on things that we've said our general plan is going to, you know, light dark sky ordinance, whatever it might be. They're just simple things that we should start addressing as a town council. That comes from your revision.
Okay. So that's easily done. I'll just take the spreadsheet and generate an action list and then forward that to Peg and you can put it out with it.
Okay.
Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be really helpful to us, I know.
Okay. So I'll have that to you by close of business next Friday.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So that is all of our agenda items. Can go ahead. I make a motion to close the general meeting and open public comments. Yes. Or do I have to do that?
I don't think you need to close that.
Okay.
It's kind of part of
this. This is part of it.
You only need to do that if it's a officially technically advertised public hearing.
Got it. Okay.
You're good to go.
All right. So we'll go ahead and open up the floor to the public again.
No, just thank you again for all the work you've done on this stuff. It's really been, you know, it's a big step forward.
Okay, looks like we have no public comments, so the next item is upcoming business for May 9th. I've made a couple of notes as we went through this, so we want to talk about the economic opportunity ordinance, correct?
Next time.
Next month. The culinary water's taken care of, we've moved that forward.
And what?
The culinary water portion ordinance, that's already moving forward, right? So we don't need to do that?
You need to take a vote to schedule it for a public hearing next time, right?
I don't think we did. Yeah.
We did. So
hearing. We'll have a public hearing.
Yeah. So both the things we discussed, you're going
to... Okay.
So yeah, do we want to next time? Do we want to include the general plan in that public hearing?
That'd be two separate public hearings.
We could have do
that. I think we could.
Yeah.
I think the water should be pretty quick.
Okay.
Okay, so two public hearings, an ordinance on economic opportunity. Am I missing anything?
I don't know if it'll be an ordinance yet, but it'll be a draft of something where you start kicking ideas around the place.
Okay.
Okay. And then just our regular. We'll stick with the public comments at the beginning, at the end.
Do we want to, just to follow up on our presentation on the Dark Skies Initiative, do we want to start looking into that a little further as a planning commission and an ordinance?
I think that's an action item. It's when do we want to bring that forward? Should we get these other two out of the way first?
I think that would be good. I think in the meantime also, the town council has some money that was donated in a fund, and they could actually start just going and based upon what we've heard here, talk to Garte, get the correct light fixture that we know is going to get compliant. They have a new one that's 2,700, whatever it was.
Yeah.
Then if we could actually start spending some of that money and get it in place, then people can kind of see. Well, it's still lighting the area. It's just not, you know, I just can't see it from a half a mile away. So I'm sacrificing, that's our bigger challenge, not sacrificing anything from a safety point of view.
Right.
But I think we've got quite a bit of education and different ways to approach this first before we bring it to you as an ordinance.
Okay.
It's up to you, but.
Well, I would like to see a nonprofit. I would like to see how they did it, is have a nonprofit do a lot of the footwork.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Right. It would be nice to find like a lead volunteer that can sort of just run with it and work between all the different things that have to go on here.
Somebody like Mary, she's just on fire about this. And if we could find somebody locally that really wanted to roll with that, be great.
Is that some announcement we can make via, or the town council can make, looking for someone who is willing to, or is that not support their role? Yeah.
I'm not sure it needs to come from the town council specifically.
Yeah. Can it just be spread word of mouth that we're looking for someone?
Because we've announced that we have the funding.
Yeah.
And now we have the map on how to get there.
You all have been announced for the last two or three town council meetings. It's been discussed, at least.
So it's just a matter of finding someone, but I don't know the best way to go about it.
Yeah.
A volunteer, too.
Yeah.
Not a queen volunteer.
When does anyone know when the next BC meeting is?
They just had one, I know.
They just had one. Did Pam already leave?
Yeah.
I'd be willing to go present to BCA to try and find someone.
I would say let's do that, Ralph. So.
Okay.
Okay.
I got that.
Thank you.
Wait, this is not an agenda.
No.
No, sorry.
No. Not yet.
Not yet. We'll do the ordinance part when it's time.
Okay, anything else on upcoming business? Perry?
Yep.
Good. Okay.
Then I move to adjourn the meeting.
Can I second that motion?
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank you. Thanks for calling in, Harry.
Yep, thank you.
Yep, bye. Now we're that's true. That's good. Yeah. I did say that you were here. Oh. Not bad, 8 o'clock.
Right.
Yeah.